So Crimes Task Force. So this is really going to be a barn burner?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Right.
I just talked to...
Call this committee to order.
I just want to say hi.
Happy New Year, everyone. Happy new session. We're in the 89th legislative session of the Minnesota Legislature, first meeting of the Senate Transportation and Public Safety Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee. That's right. So we're waiting for Senator Latz. I jumped the gun a little bit, but I'm sure he'll be along shortly here. We had our witnesses at the table at least 15 minutes ago. It's very ready for us to get going. So very, very much appreciate everyone's attendance and appreciate our federal prosecutor, Andy Luger, here. Oh, right here. So members, just a couple of quick opening comments specifically to the Transportation Public Safety Committee members. We're going to have our first informational hearing next Wednesday, but before that time, we're distributing to everyone, I think similar to what we did last time, a sheet asking for your ideas for issues or other subjects to be heard. I think we did a pretty good job of getting to most of those last time. You might have missed a couple, so if we did, just remind me what we did not get to. I also wanted to mention quickly, because two longtime lobbyists asked me, what is the transportation's interest in financial crimes? This is the Transportation and Public Safety Committee, a jurisdiction that we've had for quite some time. So we're meeting as the Public Safety Policy Committee. With that, Chair Latz, do you want to make any comments of introduction?
Thank you. Well, welcome back to the Capitol, and we're all going to make a lot of wrong turns trying to find our way to wherever we're going session, I think. You go the way you want to go, and it's got a big wall up in front of you. You can't do it. I have a new committee administrator to introduce, Emily Leffholz. So welcome. She's my former committee administrator, Cheryl Iwakim, is now a member of the House of Representatives. So Emily comes to us from the House of Representatives. She handled the two of the three counterpart committees in the House that were related to judiciary and civil law. We're also going to have other issues, issues coming up this legislative session with short time frames and short committee schedules. So for those members of the committees or others who want to have bills heard, please get your requests in early and promptly. And we will certainly do what we can to hear your bills. See, right now we're planning to have the first committee hearing for judiciary on January 13 at noon here in this room. So we're looking through the bill introductions and other items to see what exactly will be on the agenda, but you should plan accordingly, and we'll let you know if that changes. That's all I've got. Thank you.
Thanks for reminding me. I have a new person to introduce as well, new legislative assistant, Kyle Olson, who is taking Ted York's place. And Kyle hails from the fine city of Moorhead, so proving that I'm a one Minnesota kind of guy. A few months ago, Prosecutor Luger approached myself and Chair Latz to talk about the fine work that's being conducted out of his office, and a lot of it is the legacy of the Financial Crimes Task Force. Work is hampered somewhat by the fact that while there is a kind of a authorization for a task force in law, we haven't not been funding it for quite some time. That stems back to deficit years. And that was one of the items that kind of fell to the cutting room floor. And so he's here to talk about some of the work that's been going on and some of the issues that are emerging, and talk about why it might be prudent to take a fresh look at the Financial Crimes Task Force as we consider developing our budget this coming year. So I appreciate your initiative. With that, we'll turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Dibble, Chairman Latz, members of the committees. We're pleased to be here. My name is Andy Luger. I'm the United States Attorney for the state of Minnesota. With me today are Chief Deputy John Kirkwood from the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. Chief Deputy Kirkwood is the chair of the advisory board of the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force. Also with me today is Police Chief Mike Goldstein from Plymouth Police Department, both of whom will speak about the task force. I'm getting some feedback. Is that me or the mic?
Maybe push it away or bring it closer to see what happens.
I've got a note here that says speak directly into the microphones, and so I'm trying to follow the rules. We'll see how I do. I want to begin by saying that it is a little unusual to have the United States Attorney come before state Senate committees, but in our view, this is an unusual task force, and so we thought we would step out of our typical lanes to be here and give you information about the work that we're doing. It's unusual because it is a highly well-coordinated and effective task force that brings together local police departments, sheriff's departments, and federal law enforcement along with the BCA, all working very carefully together to tackle some thorny criminal issues that we'll be talking about today. So it is unusual. It's also pleasure for me to be able to come to the Capitol and testify about good news. I've only testified once before here, and the last time it was to report on an investigation of the Metro Gang Strike Force. And so I vowed if I ever had something good to talk about, I'd like to come back. So thank you for having me. With that, I'm going to turn over the introductory remarks. Oh, before I go, with me from my office is Tim Rank, who is the chief of the White Collar Section of the U.S. Attorney's Office, oversees many of the cases that we'll be talking about later in my portion of the presentation. Lola Velazquez-Aguilo, who has prosecuted a number of the cases that we'll be talking about, and Tasha Terry, a public affairs specialist with the office. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Chief Deputy Kirkwood to give the overview of the task force.
Attorney Luger, could you have your staffers just kind of wave their hands so we know? Who? All right, thank you. Welcome to
the
committee.
They're in the front row. They're high achievers.
All right, excellent.
Well, good afternoon, Chairman Dibble, Chairman Latz, members of the committee, Transportation Safety and Judiciary Committee. As mentioned by Mr. Luger, my name is John Kirkwood. I'm the Chief Deputy with the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, and I truly appreciate you taking the time to jointly convene this group of committees today so we could present on the Financial Crimes Task Force. Our intention today is not to make a specific funding request of the task force, but rather provide a task force overview of the great work, investigative and prosecutive work that they're doing for the citizens of Minnesota, and why it's the need for an appropriate level of sustainable funding is so important to keep the task force running. I realize we have, I think, 90 minutes, but hopefully we won't take that much of your time today. In addition to being the Chief Deputy of the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, as Mr. Luger mentioned, I have served as the Financial Crimes Task Force Advisory Board Chair for 4 years. I've been a member of the Financial Crimes Task Force Advisory Board since approximately 2009 in my previous role as a Special Agent in Charge of the United States Secret Service for the Minneapolis Field Office and Minneapolis, Minnesota District. I retired from the Secret Service in late 2010 and took this position in 2011 with Ramsey County. In addition to my position as a chair, I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, who, along with the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association, have strongly supported the efforts of the Financial Crimes Task Force. As I mentioned earlier, in addition to providing an overview of the task force and its accomplishments, we are here also to emphasize the critical importance of local law enforcement participation to the survival of the Financial Crimes Task Force and the need to establish and develop additional dedicated sustainable funding to help restore our operating budget to a more effective level, thus encouraging local law enforcement to participate with us. I'm fortunate to have had the experience, as I mentioned, of working a variety of financial crimes with local law enforcement throughout my 25 years as a federal agent. And in those years as a federal investigator and a supervisor, I saw daily the importance of the local law enforcement relationship in identifying and investigating financial crime at the initial stages. The majority of the cases I investigated and were involved in, whether they were fraud, counterfeiting, or even protective intelligence cases with the Secret Service, were locally generated and initiated, as is true today with most of the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force cases. This was the case in several of the more recent major investigations, such as Operation Starburst, Masquerade, and Operation Mustafa, that Mr. Lugar will soon detail. Each of these cases were initially investigated by local law enforcement. I'd like to talk now a little bit about the history of the Financial Crimes Task Force. As you may know, the Financial Crimes Task Force was created by the legislature in 2000 to combat the growing problem of financial crimes on the citizens of Minnesota. These types of crimes are too widespread and multi-jurisdictional for local law enforcement agencies to handle alone, particularly identity theft. With advances in technology and our nearly cashless economic society, fraud, especially identity theft, has become increasingly pervasive in the past few years. I'd venture to say that everyone in this room has either had a friend or a relative who's been a fraud or identity theft victim, or themselves have been a victim of this insidious crime. In fact, I've been given permission to note that Claudia Brewington, our legislative liaison from Ramsey County, just recently was a victim of identity theft herself and had called our office for assistance, as well as St. Paul Police. The creation of the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force came not only at the request of law enforcement in Minnesota, but also at the urging of retail and banking sector who suffer financially along with individual victims. In 2009, the Financial Crimes Task Force was restructured and placed under the command and control of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. With the statewide reach of the BCA and their already established strong working relationship with both local and federal law enforcement, this move made great sense. The task force is a collaboration of local, state, and federal law enforcement and state federal prosecutors working closely with our private sector partners in the retail and banking industry to combat financial crimes in Minnesota. Cases are often referred from retail and banking industry to local, state, and federal law enforcement or to the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force. The task force shares a strong relationship with the retail and banking industry, who often conduct the initial investigations prior to the law enforcement referral. I also want to note with us today some of our supporters. We have some banking representatives from TCF, Wells Fargo, and I believe U.S. Bank is here as well. So thank you for joining us. The Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force Advisory Board was created in 2009 by the legislature to replace the pre-existing oversight committee. The advisory board provides guidance and oversight to the task force, but also keeps the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety apprised of task force accomplishments, challenges, and some of the emerging financial crime trends in our state. The advisory board was created by statute and is comprised of the following. The composition of the task force advisory board was also created by statute and requires that there's representation from state and local law enforcement, usually at the executive level or their designees, county and federal prosecutors, as well as a representative from the Attorney General's office, and legislative representatives from the House and Senate. We're very fortunate to have with us Senator Goodwin, who sits on our advisory board, as well as Representative John Lesch from the House side, who are both very strong supporters and regular attendees at our quarterly meetings, despite their very busy schedules. We truly appreciate their attendance. We also have private sector representatives from the retail and banking industry, as well as a seat at the table for the AARP and a representative from the Board of Public Defenders. Sitting with us right now from retail is Target, and from banking, Wells Fargo is a representative for the banking industry. Also today with us and joining us is other members of the advisory board, as well as members of the Financial Crimes Task Force and some of the investigators from the different local law enforcement agencies, as well as I recognize some of my old Secret Service cohorts back there as well. So thanks again for joining us. With the membership including local, state, and federal law enforcement partners, the task force has broad jurisdictional and prosecutive reach to investigate and disrupt financial crime offenders and organized criminal enterprises. The fraud acts committed by these criminal groups impacts victims locally, nationally, and as you'll soon learn from Mr. Lugar, globally as well. The types of cases, as I've got up here on the screen, are listed above. Not entirely limited to these cases, but these are typically the types of investigations the task force pursues. Although many of these are large-scale cases involving major banks and retailers, it's important to remember there's a strong community impact since the initial victims are often private citizens who ultimately suffer financial losses and oftentimes significant personal losses and hardships. I do have one story to that point I wanted to tell. A few years ago, prior to leaving the Secret Service, a young man came to our door, right to the door of the field office in the federal building downtown Minneapolis, with a laptop in his hands and tears in his eyes, and asking us if we could help him out on an investigation, because he knew the Secret Service and the task force pursued advanced fee scams. In this case, it was what we consider a love scam. He went on to tell myself and one of my electronic crimes agents a pretty heartfelt story about how his mother had met somebody online who pretended to be a successful businessman from Atlanta, had sent her some pictures, very handsome gentleman, wealthy, had all the right things to say, and they carried on a conversation on the internet for several months, almost a year. She'd met him on a dating website. They never met in person. She basically fell in love with him. This was a woman, I believe she was in her 50s, recently divorced, very vulnerable. Started sending him money in hopes that he would come visit her. And every time he was supposed to come visit her after she'd sent him money, he came up with some excuse that he had to travel internationally or had some important commitment. She eventually learned that she was being scammed after giving up close to $50,000 of her retirement savings. And later that day, the day she found this out, she committed suicide. We tried to do what we could to find this individual. We eventually located a possible location in a coffee shop in Lagos, Nigeria, where we believe it was the fraud was being perpetrated. But unfortunately, we were never able to find him. I make that point again just to sort of drive home how these cases aren't just retail and banking, but they do affect individuals as well. The Financial Crimes Task Force currently has participants from following local and state agencies: BCA, Duluth Police Department, Edina Police, Mille Lacs County Sheriff's Office, Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, and the St. Paul Police Department are pretty much the full-time members. We also have former participation from the Wright County Sheriff's Office, Baxter Police Department, and the Minneapolis Police Department, who recently had resigned from the task force participation. On a case-by-case basis and part-time basis, we have a lot of local, state, and law enforcement agencies that help as cases arise. And in recent months, we've been working more and more with the Plymouth and the Eagan Police Departments, who have recently entered into a memorandum of agreement with the task force. We receive assistance also from the Department of Commerce, State Department of Revenue. I should also mention State Alcohol and Gambling, who are here today as well to support us, have worked with us in the past. Federal agencies include the United States Postal Inspection Service, the IRS Criminal Investigation Service, Homeland Security Investigations, and the United States Secret Service. We receive part-time participation as well from Social Security Office Inspector General, the FBI, Veterans Administration, ATF, and the United States State Department. Each of these agencies have some degree of fraud oversight as part of their investigative purview, and each brings special talents, assets, and resources to the Financial Crimes Task Force. I would like now to invite Mr. Luger to provide some Financial Crimes Task Force summaries on some of the exemplary work that the agents and officers have been doing.
Attorney Luger, would you like members to ask questions along the way or to wait?
You know, I think it would be fine to ask questions along the way. I want to make sure we have enough time for everybody, so I don't... I'm used to being interrupted, so I have no problem with that.
Professional, or are you talking about your household?
Every aspect of my life.
I have a question, two questions, well, two-part question. One is, why do the Minneapolis police no longer participate, and has the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office ever participated?
Hennepin County Sheriff's Office?
Oh, right.
To my knowledge, no. I know we've had discussions with them in the past, and they did entertain the thoughts of helping on a part-time basis. It usually comes down to staffing and resources and the availability of people. But in the case of Minneapolis Police Department, because of the reduction in the budget over the years, we no longer are able to pay salary reimbursements, which I was going to go into a little bit further after Mr. Luger was done, as to what the original model of the task force was when there was a little bit of money. But because there was no longer salary reimbursement, Minneapolis, Baxter, and Wright County could no longer afford to have an officer as a full-time member.
Great. Thank you.
So Chairman Dibble, Chairman Latz, I was sworn in as United States Attorney on February 14th, a Friday afternoon, and I asked the section chiefs in my office. I asked the section chiefs in my office to stick around that Friday afternoon, and it was a long President's Weekend, over the weekend, to brief me on the top five cases in their section. Having them come in over President's Weekend made me one of the more popular U.S. attorneys immediately upon my taking office. Tim Rank, who's here today, is the chief of the white-collar section, and in the top five cases that he wanted to brief me on my first day in office, two of them are cases we're going to talk about today from the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force. And he briefed me on the background and the successful relationship that our office had with the task force. And since I was heavily involved in criminal justice issues and knew nothing about this, I figured at some point the members of the legislature who had created this task force perhaps could use some information as well. If I didn't know anything about it, I thought maybe some of you might not know all the details as well. And that led to why we requested to be here today. This is an extraordinary operation because the cases that we bring often begin with a local police officer noticing something, coming across a crime that in the past, without the existence of this task force, would have been handled purely at the local level. And I'll talk about that when we talk about some of these cases. The two most significant cases that predated my tenure as United States Attorney, Operation Starburst and Operation Masquerade, I'll give you some background on cases that were prosecuted and tried in 2011, 12, and 13. And then this year, we have been extremely busy in our work at the U.S. Attorney's Office with the task force, Operation Avalanche, Mustafa, and the others that I'll talk about. So the first case that I want to lead off with, a very significant, large case prosecuted by my office before I got there in coordination with the task force, was Operation Starburst. This began with the Edina Police Department. As often these cases do, a police officer sees a bad check, has some concerns about it, and can either simply prosecute or investigate for prosecution that bad check case alone. But luckily, we have police officers with the foresight to consider the fact that this may be part of something larger. And over the course of a number of years and investigations, we found 27 people who were participating in what turned into a $50 million bank fraud conspiracy. One of the highlights of that case was the fact that the conspirators had convinced people inside of banks to work with them to steal information on bank accounts so that one can create phony checks and cash them. The fraud scheme was not only in Minnesota, but it was elsewhere in the country, and it took place over a five-year period. The two ringleaders of this were sentenced to a total of 590 months in prison. I highlight that because for essentially a white-collar case in the federal district court in Minnesota, that's an extraordinary amount of time for people to serve. And so at the bottom of this slide, we quote from Chief Judge Michael Davis, who said it's one of the largest frauds he'd ever seen, and it was sophisticated using bank insiders. This is, and as noted on this slide, there are thousands of individual victims, particularly in Minnesota. And at one point, it was determined that 40% of all fraudulent check activity in Minnesota was tied to this organization. And so with one investigation from one task force, Secret Service, BCA, and our local partners all working together with our office, we were able to dismantle an entire organization that was responsible for so much of the fraudulent check activity going on in our state. I can tell you that in talking to fellow U.S. attorneys around the country, most of them don't have this type of a task force to work with, and they're not able to bring the kinds of cases that I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes. We are, and it's very, very important to our office. We're very proud of this task force. Second case that predated me was Operation Masquerade, a check forgery ring that was discovered by the Baxter Police Department. And it was another identity theft ring that spanned many states. In order to create phony checks, in order to victimize businesses and individuals, it often begins with identity theft, because identity theft is not simply when someone takes your credit card and uses it against your will and you've got to then work with your credit card company to reverse charges. Often what we're finding through the work of the task force is that identity theft is part of a larger ring that then goes on to do something else. Your personal identity information is used in a number of ways. As I'll talk about with the Mustafa case, it's used in a cell phone fraud ring. As part of Masquerade and Avalanche, it's used to create phony checks. Businesses, bank customers, a lot of small businesses are defrauded as a result of this kind of a crime. In 2012 and 2013, 28 defendants were convicted. Again, ringleaders sentenced to 300 months in prison. Just an extraordinary statement about how seriously our federal bench is taking these cases. And it's another case that was organized and investigated by this task force, working along with federal and local partners. Baxter Police Department, for example. We normally, in my office, would go years without seeing a Baxter police officer coming and working with us, or an Edina police officer. We now have an Edina police officer working almost full-time in our office on one of these cases. And it's great work. It's great partnerships. One of the things I learned, unfortunately, upon becoming U.S. attorney was that federal, state, local resources are not quite, for law enforcement, are just not quite where they were when I was a prosecutor in the 80s and 90s. And there were just many more FBI agents and other agents dedicated to white-collar crime. For a number of reasons, that's just not the case right now. And so we are working very closely with our state and local partners, and it's a pleasure to do so. One of the two financial crimes task force cases that Mr. Rank briefed me on that first weekend that I was in office was Operation Avalanche. There are a number of pieces to Avalanche, but essentially this is a widespread criminal enterprise that has been manufacturing phony checks by stealing people's identity. The victims range from individuals to small businesses, many of whom we worked closely with, who had learned that their employees or others had distributed their checks inadvertently on some occasions to members of this conspiracy, who then used sophisticated printing technology to print up whole batches of checks that appeared to be these small businesses' checks, and then they would employ runners to go from bank to bank to bank to try to cash the checks. The amount of money grew over time. The sophistication was such that they also, the members of this conspiracy and criminal organization, went online, and we were able to find out that, as depicted in the bottom portion of this slide, there is an Instagram site, and I say all this as though I really know what Instagram is, but I have to act like I do. Instagram site where primarily young adults would go on and post their first paycheck. And it's literally called At My First Paycheck. And if you go to At My – yes?
Hashtag.
Oh, hashtag.
My First Paycheck.
I'm really hoping my kids don't watch this. Hashtag My First Paycheck, where people were encouraged, young adults primarily, to post their first paycheck. And this sophisticated criminal conspiracy trolled that hashtag and would download information from those paychecks, create new checks, and defraud businesses. We had a law firm that was defrauded as part of Operation Avalanche. We were able to bring charges against 28 people, shut down this operation. 75 federal, state, and local law enforcement officers were involved in the day that we brought down this operation. It's an ongoing case, and we're very, very proud of the work that went into this, because, again, somebody in a local police department could simply look at one of these instances of fraud and determine that it was something that was happening in Edina or in Bloomington or Plymouth, and that kind of was the way these things were treated in the past. By communicating across lines and using this task force to do it, the BCA, the Secret Service, and the others involved, we're able to connect all these dots and shut down an entire operation. The next case that I'll talk about...
Attorney Lugar?
Yep.
So I just pulled it up. Looks like it still exists. Has there any work been done with Instagram to try to persuade them
There has been a lot of dialogue and a lot of communication. In the week or two after this case came down, we were able to observe what I'll define as chatter online about don't go to my first paycheck, hashtag my first paycheck. People were talking about the fact that this was being used to rip off businesses and individuals. I don't have the ability that I'm aware of to actually shut it down. Mm-hmm. I can only suggest.
Great. Thanks.
The Mustafa family crime ring is another unusual set of circumstances that we are in Minnesota taking the lead on nationally in prosecuting this kind of case. For years, we've all heard complaints about violent crime that was designed to steal cell phones and people who were literally beaten up on the streets, particularly at the University of Minnesota, but elsewhere around the state, for cell phones. And you kind of wonder, is it really worth it to steal a cell phone to go to those lengths? What we found out was it is, actually, because there's a market primarily overseas for stolen cell phones. And so working... Primarily, this one began with the St. Paul Police Department, noticing a number of cell phone thefts. We also found out that this ring, early on we learned that this ring was engaged in ID theft. ID theft, so such that one would steal your identity and use your identity to go to your cell phone supplier. So if you had your cell phone from Sprint or Verizon, one could go pretending to be you with all of your identifying information and ask to expand your plan. So maybe you had one cell phone, but on a family plan you could have 10. All you needed to do is sign a contract to expand the number of phones that you would have, pay a small fee, and promise over a course of time that you would pay a much larger monthly charge. What we learned is that people were literally going into Verizon, Sprint, and other stores with false identities that they had stolen from a citizen or taken from a citizen and ordering up 10, 15, sometimes more phones, signing the contract on behalf of that citizen, and then walking out with all of the phones, tearing up the contract, throwing it in the garbage, and then they could turn around and sell these phones that they had obtained for $50 or $100 a piece for as much as $3,000 overseas. And the Mustafa crime ring was essentially gathering all of these phones. Now, what happens is the citizen who doesn't know this is happening would get a bill in the mail and a thank you letter in the mail from, say, Verizon saying, we really appreciate your expanding from one or two cell phones to 10, and here's your new bill. And then they have to unwork all of that. So we worked closely with the cell phone providers to learn about what was happening to them, and over the course of a number of years investigated this case, and we were able last summer to indict 20 members of this crime family, and we're working through those cases now. They owned 13 stores that people could go into and buy a phone, which we raided on the day that we arrested everybody. We found $4 million on the day that we took this case down, we estimated about $4 million in fraudulent cell phone thefts and sales. And to show you the dedication that federal law enforcement has to this task force, given the number of storefronts and the number of people to be arrested, and given the analysis that we wanted to do immediately upon gathering the phones, we seized thousands, I think it was over 5,000 phones that day that were fraudulently obtained. The Secret Service flew in 100 agents from around the country. to prepare for this operation. And so in total, between the Secret Service's 100 agents, BCA, our local partners, we ended up with 300 law enforcement officers out during that day, making sure the arrests went smoothly, the searches went smoothly, and that we could begin to decipher where these phones came from, find victims, and let them know. And that's a process that's going on right now. One of the things that happens when you take down a case of this nature is some of the people involved begin to talk to you and tell you more information, more aspects of the criminal enterprise. We recently arrested an individual who was supplying phones to the Mustafa crime organization, and he had his own unique way of doing so. He would scout out Verizon cell phone stores, for example, in strip malls, and identify the business next door. And if he thought, based on his own reconnaissance, that the business next door didn't have an alarm system, sometimes it was like hairdressers or nail salons, he would break in at night to the next door business and basically hack his way through the wall into the Sprint or Verizon store, take all of the phones in the Sprint or Verizon store, bring them back, and provide them for a fee to the Mustafa crime family. We discovered this again, one, through some help from people who were helping us in the criminal world, but also the diligent work of police officers who are aware of these kind of robberies and break-ins, thought that they were not only suspicious as robberies, but that they might be linked up to something larger. Bring that to the task force, and we have over a dozen robberies just in Minnesota alone, but more that took place in other states by this one individual who we brought charges against. So the work of these cases continues and expands. And I will tell you, I didn't take this job for thank you letters or notes, and I don't get a lot. But on the Mustafa case alone,
maybe center their microphones. Maybe their microphones are interfering with each other. All right. Proceed.
The Mustafa case alone generated more letters of thanks, emails, and phone calls from the community than anything else I've done since I've been United States Attorney. People telling their stories of being beaten up for a phone, or of having this type of a fraud, you know, going home from work one day and finding out they got a letter in the mail from their cell phone provider thanking them for taking, 20 phones out that obviously they hadn't done. So this was a case that really brought down a very significant ring. I've received calls from U.S. attorneys in other parts of the country who believe that they're suffering from the same kind of a fraud and violent crime ring and wanted advice. And so, again, I'm pretty proud of our task force. Next case I'll touch on is the Joku case. This is an individual who was a debt collector and decided to use his prowess as a debt collector to harass and intimidate people and defraud businesses by stealing identifying information, impersonating victims, impersonating them so they could defraud their financial institutions. But he also, not only would he open phony bank accounts using their information, he would also try to collect on phony debts. Once he had somebody's identifying information, he would insinuate to them that they had a debt and he was here to collect it. And he was particularly vicious in the way he went after folks. So we had one person in a wheelchair who he threatened to throw off the side of a cliff. He was sentenced to 175 months in prison. He was convicted on 33 counts of fraud. Final case I'll touch on is what we called Operation Homeless.
Give me 1 second. Sorry.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Although we're familiar, this is a different sound than that usually is. Yeah. All right. We're calling our technicians, so we'll just persevere and suffer through it until they solve it for us.
I have far fewer problems when I came for the Metro Gang Strike Force. Operation Homeless was a sophisticated bank fraud scheme. Four defendants, they would steal mail from suburban office parks, getting small businesses mail. They would use that to create phony checks. And then they employed homeless people to go from bank to bank to try to cash the checks. And so some very observant local police officers thought there might be a pattern to this. This was a bit unusual. Again, brought it to the strike force, the task force, and between Ramsey County and the postal inspectors and the work of this task force, able to track down what Mr. Joe Poo was doing and prosecute him and get him put behind bars. A difficult case in some respects because some of our best witnesses were homeless individuals who were brought to court and sort of gut-wrenching stories that they had to tell and really being used by a criminal to bring about what was, you know, over $200,000 in stolen checks for his use. So that's a little bit about some of the cases. I could go on and on, but I won't. Just an example of what we've done in 2014, 56 people charged in federal court, a number charged in Ramsey, Hennepin, and other counties. I can tell you that we want to continue this work. I have a new unit at the U.S. Attorney's Office called the Special Prosecutions Unit. They will be handling many of these cases going forward because this is the work that these criminal organizations are doing doesn't neatly fall into just white collar or just violent crime or street crime. So I've put people with expertise in white collar and street crime together in a unit, and they are going to be handling many of these cases going forward. We're very interested in doing this work. We really like working with our state and local partners. I can tell you that working with BCA has been an extraordinary pleasure for me and for those in my office, and I can't tell you how highly we think of this task force.
Thank you, Mr. Lugar. Chairman Ladds, Chairman Dibble, and committee, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the funding, but first I'd be remiss if I didn't also recognize that we have one of our Ramsey County attorneys, prosecutors with us as well today, and as you can see from our numbers, they've really made this a priority. I know that John Choi has got one ADA assistant county attorney who is full-time. John Ristad is full-time doing nothing but task force cases and fraud cases that my deputy and others produce for him, and our hats off to them for their participation.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, sorry. Senator.
To your left. I'm just curious. It looks like Ramsey County has an extraordinary number of charges as compared to the other 86 counties in the state, or maybe they are wrapped up in the federal court jurisdictions. Could you just comment on sort of the makeup of where these charges are coming from and why Ramsey County would have such a high number?
Attorney Lugar.
Yes. A number of the big investigations that we've had have focused on the Ramsey County side of the river. And, for example, the Mustafa case was investigated originally by the St. Paul Police Department. So what often happens in these cases is many of the players are investigated and prosecuted federally, but there'll be some folks, runners at the kind of lower level, those who their job is solely to go try to cash a check. And depending on their criminal history, depending on how involved they were, we're communicating with our county attorney partners, Hennepin, Ramsey, but all over the state, about who should prosecute what case. This kind of activity is very much centered in the metro area. But as you can tell with Baxter and other, we have worked across state lines, across the county lines, with state and local partners.
Chief Deputy Kirkwood.
Yes, I'd also like to add, too, that having that full-time member on the task force, in our case, Deputy Rob Wilkinson, who would be here today but is actually in Atlanta following up on this case with his postal inspector partner. It helps a lot because I've completely dedicated that position to the task force. Once in a while we use him for other things in the county, in the sheriff's office, but he's primarily dedicated to working financial crimes for the task force, primarily representing other departments within Ramsey County, suburban police departments, bringing their cases forward for state and federal prosecution. So that's one of the reasons as well. It's the importance of having that full-time membership and being able to do that.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to know, where do you come up with those really cool names for all of these crimes? No, I'm just kidding. I have a question that is relative to the Department of Commerce and the Insurance Fraud Bureau, and I'm just wondering, what kind of work do you do collaboratively? Is there somebody from the Insurance Fraud Bureau on the task force, and what kind of communication do you have within that?
I can tell you that from the Chief past, Deputy, they have perfect. Worked. There's not a full-time member of the task force from Commerce, but we do work closely. The commander of the Financial Crimes Task Force, Scott Mueller, does work with their department on a regular basis. I know that we've had, I believe it was with Operation Starburst, some of the collateral cases there that we're involved in, also involved what we call crash scams, insurance scams, where individuals will run into each other on the cars and they'll have a friend that will be a doctor and a friend that's a chiropractor, and they'll be helping the system in various ways. Those are oftentimes the same people that are committing identity counterfeit checks and everything else. And it was Commerce that really helped us with that case and bring that case forward. But I know we work very closely with them on an overlapping basis, and I'm sure that will continue in the years to come.
One other point on that. My office works very closely with Commerce on insurance, real estate, and investment frauds. And so, again, realizing, as we all do, at the state and the federal level, the resources aren't quite what they were, it's turned into an important part of our work in the white-collar section to work with Commerce on a wide variety of fraud scams. We do.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I just want to say thank you for your work. We really appreciate it, that you work. I think my question has more to do, though, with how do you find out? My husband and I were victims of a theft from our mailbox, and the brazenness and the sophisticated approach that they took, they obviously were that, and how did they even know on this rare occasion that we actually put a check in a mailbox because we drove past the post office and forgot and thought, but we reported it. But how do you even, when I look at some of these, how do you, I'm sure it must be like a thread pulling a sweater. You maybe have one case and then things start. But do you have any sort of centralized reporting? Because there are these counties, there may be other counties, because if I think if they were this sophisticated, smart thing would be on their part, dumb as I think it is to go to multiple counties and hope that nobody will catch them because they're just one here and one there.
That's exactly what they do, and that's, again, the need for the collaboration with all the different jurisdictions, because these individuals are smart enough to know that if they hit one county for 300 or 500 here or 1,000 here and then go to another county for 400 or 500, they can keep it under certain prosecutor levels or investigative interest levels, and meanwhile they're racking up quite a bit of fraud. As to a centralized location, the Federal Trade Commission does have, they do a very good job. I think it's Federal Trade Commission does a very good job, has a good website for identity theft victims. And there's actually all sorts of material. There's a reporting process if you are a victim of identity theft that you can make at a federal level. Those cases are oftentimes then referred out to either an FBI task force or one of ours. But again, this is a reason for the beauty of the Financial Crimes Task Force. It is kind of a centralized one-stop shop for departments and agencies that may have a series of financial crime in their jurisdiction but don't have the resources or ways to follow up. They can work with the agencies at the Financial Crimes Task Force who may be familiar with the case, because the same person in Scott County has also hit some people in Kennebec County or hit them in Wright County. It may be the same crew, and by having that central group that's working the larger organizations, you can pull it all together and make the cases larger. And as Mr. Luger was pointing out, the reason for these large, these high sentences, these extraordinarily high sentences that the federal judges are handing out, is because of the dollar amounts, the relevant value that's brought together on these frauds from all over, and the high dollar amounts, which get them over the sentencing guidelines and get the better sentences. As far as your check, you said you had a check or some mail stolen. Oftentimes, and criminals have been doing this for years, we used to, when I worked check cases years ago as a young agent, we would follow the mailman because somebody was usually following him on the end of the month on Social Security Day. I'd partner up with my postal inspector buddy, and we would just slowly tail the mailman as we knew at the time of the month when VA checks came out, Social Security checks came out, tax checks. And then we'd often watch for people that were then hitting the mailboxes and stealing those checks. But if you do put your flag up, it does telegraph you've got something to mail, obviously, and it can be taken. But it's still, people go through trash, they go through mailboxes, they break into cars. Larceny from vehicles is still one of the largest main problems we have, with ultimately leading to identity theft. The amount of information that's in your glove box is astounding and very easily transferred into an identity theft.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. And yes, it was both a personal and a business, so it was really interesting, and we didn't find out till we were notified that the quarterly corporate taxes weren't paid, and that was an interesting thing to kind of sort out. But that's how, you know, and you just wonder if they target people. The other question I have, though, is this seems to be a lot to do with check fraud or even some internal bank fraud, identity theft. I know there are a lot of people now that are switching to digital payment systems. Do you have any incidents in regards to that sort of fraud, or is it predominantly the paper check bank type situation?
It's both, and okay. There's also a piece of this that we didn't get into, but we could, which is tax fraud, because a number of identity theft rings are using the information that they're gathering to then go and file phony tax returns on your behalf. And so as people find out, they go to file their tax return on April 15th, and they get a notice from the IRS saying, your tax return's already been filed. Why are you sending us another tax return? And so somebody who had stolen their identification had filed a tax return seeking a refund. I got a call from a victim who said, you know, I got a notice that I was getting a refund. Not only am I not entitled to a refund, I'm supposed to be paying in taxes. And somebody out there in America has my refund check that I don't deserve. Now you have to go and unwork and undo all of this. It's actually become a very significant part of the work we're doing in our office.
If I could just gently remind our witnesses to wait until I call upon you to speak and also address your comments to the chair. Thank you. Anything further?
Nope, that's it, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Luger, has there been a distinct pattern that's been created on the part of identifiable perpetrators? You made mention that there was a something had originated in, was it Kenya? And is this something that's originated from other countries? Or are the people that have been investigated, are they new to this nation? Are they immigrants?
U.S. Attorney Luger.
Yeah. Chair Dibble, Senator Limmer, the origins of these fraud rings spans every conceivable definition. So, yes, we have some immigrant communities that have been involved in this. What has been most interesting to me is how these quickly become cross-cultural organized crime rings, such that you might see, like in the Mustafa ring, people from the Middle East, but they're teaming up with, and Chief Goldstein will talk about this as well, they're teaming up with former drug dealers, former gang members, who have determined that a so-called white-collar crime is a safer and more lucrative way to go than drugs or guns. So we'll see some of the people leading the scheme might be from an immigrant community, and then people operating the scheme we often see are people who have been convicted previously of violent crimes, drug crimes, street crimes.
Great. I think we have more of your presentation to get through.
Chairman Dibble, Chairman Latz, members of the committee, I'd like to talk a little bit about the funding history of the Financial Crimes Task Force. In 2000, with the help of the legislature and the U.S. Attorney, the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force had a pretty healthy budget of close to $1 million to operate with. At that time, due to this healthy budget, it was decided the best use of the funds was by incentivizing participation through salary reimbursement of the local law enforcement affiliates. In other words, we were paying the officers' salaries to stay on the task force. This model carried forward over the years, but faced significant challenges as the funding to the Financial Crimes Task Force was decreased. As you can see, 2008 was $750,000, and then 2011 we began receiving an annualized budget of $300,000 up through 2014. These numbers, however, don't include some funding, additional funding that came from OJP, which was not always a specific amount, but varied from year to year. As a practical matter, it was decided last summer, due to the decrease in this funding, that through a vote of the advisory board, that a recommendation be made to the Commissioner of Public Safety to cease the reimbursement model in favor of using limited funds to reimburse overtime, investigative costs, travel and training that was being incurred by our local law enforcement affiliates to help, in other words, alleviate the load on those departments that were hosting these members on the task force. But even with this change in the annual task force operating expenses, the limited funds that were remaining for overtime, purchase of equipment, rewards, and the education and training were quite limited and have to be sparsed out very carefully. If we were to receive additional funds each year, obviously we could use that to help with our local law enforcement involvement. I believe all in law enforcement would agree that there is a greater good in fighting fraud in the state, even with crimes extending beyond our individual jurisdictions. However, just as with other Minnesota state task forces and federally sponsored task forces, in order to generate participation of local affiliates, it's important to offer some sort of financial incentive, as I mentioned, to help offset local department budgetary constraints. The increased funding, of course, would help provide for additional overtime, investigative expenses and training, equipment, travel and expenses, as well as public education and outreach, and even reward money for tips that we receive, thus generating more local law enforcement participation with the task force. As an administrator, I can say that one of the more challenging things I face, and I know Chief Goldstein would say the same, is when you have a hardworking bulldog investigator who's very aggressive and you have to limit their productivity because you can't pay them the additional overtime that they're willing to work and hours away from home because your budget won't stand for it. So it is one of the more frustrating aspects. Without the additional funding, sustainable funding, some of the things the task force risks, primarily the loss of our local participants, just like we did with Minneapolis Police recently, Baxter Police, and Wright County Sheriff's Office. Without the local law enforcement, the task force eventually could dissolve, potentially resulting in fraud cases prioritized low behind more significant crimes against persons and property, no multi-jurisdictional collaborative to address the issue of fraud, a significant decrease in arrests and prosecution, thus fraud growth and increases in victimization, and no combined force to address the problem. State and federal agencies will be challenged without the force multiplier of local law enforcement participation and will become more case selective, leaving less cases investigated, more victims without recourse or hopes of restitution. It's another important point to make with the local participation, especially for my old alma mater, federal agency, the Secret Service. If you don't have that local law enforcement partner there for the continuity of the case, it can really be detrimental to the case prosecution and adjudication, especially with the Secret Service who faces the challenges of the protective mission where you're called upon at any time to another part of the country or another part of the world, and you have to leave that case behind. It's always good to have that local partner to pick up the pieces behind you and carry on. Other things with the loss of the funding and the loss of our local participation, Minnesota could ultimately and potentially be perceived as a soft target state and potentially attract more fraud groups and organized criminal enterprises to establish their criminal bases here. Can you imagine where drug dealers and drug trafficking organizations would go if we lifted our pseudofedrin laws or eliminated our 24 statewide drug task forces and violent crimes task forces? We've proven through the earlier case examples, especially the Mustafa case, cell phone case that many of the same subjects perpetrating financial crimes are also tied to street crimes such as drug trafficking, aggravated assaults, robbery, and even extortion. We could likely see an increase in this activity if not hitting them from a financial crimes approach, which, as we learned years ago in this business, was very successful during the Capone era. If you remember how he eventually went to prison, was because of tax evasion. In closing, the one thing I can say now in my 34 years of law enforcement is that fighting crime, just very similar to politics itself, is truly local. I'm sure my federal law enforcement colleagues would agree the majority of federally investigated cases originate at the local level and are generated from the hard work of our local law enforcement partners. Every good fed will tell you that. This is particularly true with financial crimes, as demonstrated by some of the cases that Mr. Lugar articulated. You can have as many of the biggest heavily financed federal agencies you want, but without that strong participation, trust, and collaboration with their local law enforcement partners, effective and substantive investigation of community impact crimes will fail to occur. For these reasons, we need to keep this task force running. I'd like now to thank you, Chairman Lantz, Chairman Dibble, and committees members for allowing me to present, and I'd like to introduce Chief Mike Goldstein from the Plymouth Police Department to add some comments as well.
Welcome, Chief Goldstein.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Dibble, Chairman Lantz, and committee members. Again, my name is Mike Goldstein, and I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Plymouth, and I'm here to represent the city today, but I'm also representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, as I am a Vice President on their Executive Board. I want to thank all of you for the opportunity to testify today on this important topic for Minnesota law enforcement. I'm here to offer and explain my support for the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force, as this task force provides a unique and incredibly important crime-fighting function within the state of Minnesota. As you've heard from Chief Deputy Kirkwood and U.S. Attorney Lugar, the task force is a multi-jurisdictional unit comprised of talented investigators who possess the requisite skills and experience to prudently investigate highly complex financial crime-related cases that many law enforcement agencies in Minnesota do not have the expertise to conduct. The task force is an imperative asset for Minnesota law enforcement's community, and it needs to be appropriately sustained in that if it dissolves, there is no entity to fill the void, and a large number of crime victims will have no place to turn. Due to the strength and outreach and capabilities of the task force, a collaborative and highly functional effort between local, state, and federal law enforcement entities has solved a number of significant crimes for both Minnesotans and Minnesota-based businesses. I can tell you firsthand that the task force has helped members of our community. Some of the large investigations described by Mr. Lugar involved Plymouth victims. I can also tell you that there is no shortage of individuals or organized crime syndicates that are involved in substantial financial crime rings. In fact, violent career criminals have entered into this arena where they can illegally earn more money with far less risk to their well-being. Criminals commit crimes for financial gain, and when there is less risk, the opportunities are far more lucrative. The good news is that for those who choose to participate, the evidence they produce is usually irrefutable, but generally not easy to detect by a general investigator. Moreover, there are other issues that I'd like to highlight that speak to some of the additional needs for this task force. Another hat that I wear is I am the vice chair of the Violent Crime Coordinating Council, which under state statute offers oversight to the 20-plus violent crime enforcement teams, better known as drug or violent crime task forces across the state of Minnesota. As such, I can attest to the fact that law enforcement is quite good at chasing the drugs and the people involved in the drug and violent crime trade, but we are not so good at tracking the money involved in these cases. And if we truly want to thwart and deter criminals, specifically organized crime, including the cartel, from conducting their criminal operations here in Minnesota, we need to support the efforts of the Financial Crimes Task Force. Again, the nexus between most crimes is money, and we need to do a better job of connecting the dots that, as of now, only this task force really has the expertise to do. Even though my department is directly involved with two different drug task forces, we do not possess the capability to manage these complex financial matters, and we are a fairly self-supporting organization. Smaller agencies across the state are in a similar or more challenging position, and we need this task force. This task force could have the opportunity to provide training to smaller law enforcement organizations to better create a network where these investigations could be conducted in a more collaborative fashion. And there are other advantages, as all of us have stated here today, related to the work of the task force. Again, in my tenure as chief, our department has partnered with the Financial Crimes Task Force, where we have encountered cases that taxed our investigators' capabilities and resources. At times, we've been able to have one of our investigators liaison with the task force for a temporary period of time as these larger cases unfolded, and at other times, we simply relied on task force investigators for advice. The value add for our department and for departments across the state is immense. One of our former investigators, who's now with Wells Fargo, is here, and he participated as a liaison to the Financial Crimes Task Force. His name is Darren McGann, and did a lot of real wonderful work that, again, tied into some of the cases that were highlighted before you this afternoon. I'd like to make a couple of final comments. First of all, I think it's incredibly important for everyone in this room and beyond to understand how lucky we are. And I'm not here to kiss up, but I am here to offer my great gratitude for U.S. Attorney Lugar and his office, in that with his leadership on this issue and beyond, we are in really, really good hands across the state of Minnesota. We are being incredibly assertive, if not aggressive, in this area due to his leadership, and it is something that all Minnesotans can benefit from. I also want to thank Chief Deputy Kirkwood for his leadership on the Oversight Board for the Financial Crimes Task Force. He's very passionate about this, and for good reason, in that this task force, as we've stated a number of times today, is so very important. When Chief Deputy Kirkwood spoke of the case that was brought to him when he was still with the Secret Service, where that woman unfortunately committed suicide, I can share with you that today's only Thursday, and since Monday, our department has investigated two financial crime-related cases, one more bizarre than the other. I won't refer to that one right now, but the second one involved a case where a person realized that his online love was not real, and the thousands of dollars that he had sent to her in New York, he'd come to the realization that it wasn't really going to her. And he was despondent, and as of yesterday, made a decision to take his life. We were lucky enough to intervene prior to him doing so and got him the help that he needed. So for us, that was a success, but it's something that has complicated his life to the point of where he wanted to take his life. So again, those are just two higher profile situations that kind of tug at the heartstrings. But the reality is that we have victims across this state where, as Senator Kiffmeyer asked, what happens when these cases are reported to law enforcement? We're good at ticking them off sort of one by one, but we're not really good in when we have to aggregate things and look at the stronger ties that they have across the country, across the globe. And this task force provides that resource for all of Minnesota law enforcement agencies. And without it, again, there's no one to fill the void. So I thank you for your time today and your attention. And if you have any questions, certainly we'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Chief Goldstein. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have two questions. First, are there similar task forces in other states that you partner with, since this seems to be interstate crime in many cases? And two, as you talk about the funding, it sounds like you've got a commitment from counties and local jurisdictions. How does the cost sharing work? Are they paying for those officers to be there, or is the state covering that portion of the
U.S. Attorney Lugar?
Senator Chairman Dibble, Senator Pratt, the answer to the first question is no. We work with FBI, postal inspectors, Secret Service around the country when cases lead us there, but we're not aware of a similar task force such as this. As I've said, some of my colleagues in other offices are envious that we have this state, federal, local resource. I'm going to turn to Chief Deputy Kirkwood to answer the second question, although I will tell you the Avalanche case, which is one of the larger cases in my office right now, the participation from the Edina Police Force on that case has been tremendous. And with the problems of funding, but the case is ongoing, we determined that we needed an Edina police officer to spend a great deal of time at our office working on the case. And since there isn't money available from the task force to pay for it, the U.S. Attorney's Office is paying the Edina Police Department for his time, for a bulk, not all, but a majority of his time. And I do that because it's the right thing to do for the case, although I will tell you it's killing me from a budget standpoint. And I'm happy to talk about my budget woes, but maybe we can do that another time.
Chief Deputy Kirkwood.
Chairman Dibble and Senator Pratt, as Mr. Luger mentioned, you know, the local participation oftentimes is done without any type of remuneration or reimbursement to the department. I know, speaking for my department, I ponied up a deputy from the onset when I became chair, more than anything to set an example, hoping others would follow, without any type of reimbursement until just last year we started receiving some overtime reimbursement for his hard work. In terms of splitting the limited amount of funds we have after paying our analyst salaries and costs of keeping the lights on and everything else, we had a pretty finite amount when we were still doing the reimbursements that we split three or four ways, however many local affiliates were there, and rather than getting full-time reimbursement or full reimbursement for their full-time employee, they were getting a portion of it. It went from, I think at one point back in 2000, some of the departments were getting upwards to $80,000, $90,000 a year, and now in the last couple of years it's been closer to $10,000 or $15,000 for that salary reimbursement, which doesn't come near what the true salary with benefits and everything else would come to. Now that we've eliminated that reimbursement model, any department that's in at this point, whether sheriff's office, police department, they're not receiving any financial reimbursement for salaries, but will receive it for those extra hours that the deputy or officer can commit to the task force in terms of overtime. But again, that's a very limited amount that we receive. We do get some help from our federal partners as well, though, in terms of some offsetting the overtime and some of the equipment and training costs.
Just a quick comment. I've worked in financial services. I've worked with victims of financial crimes. I know how devastating this is to victims and how disruptive it is, and quite honestly, oftentimes expensive for them to resolve of being a victim, both in time and in expense. So thank you for your effort.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Senator Latz.
Thank you. It kind of follows on those comments. Clearly, there's interstate issues going on here, and so I think the big question may become, does or should the federal government be picking up more of the cost of the Financial Crimes Task Force and salary reimbursements? You know, it's a question we're going to have to answer here as we contemplate whether and how much money, state money, to put into it.
U.S. Attorney Luger.
Chairman Dibbles. Chairman Latz, the amount of – it's hard to quantify the amount of money that the federal government is putting in. As I said, you know, Secret Service for the Mustafa case flew in 100 agents from around the country to help with that operation. They have essentially full-time case agents working on these cases. Postal inspectors, the IRS, and others are all contributing to this task force. There's a need for it, and obviously, as you go forth in your discussions, if you have further questions for us, we'd be happy to come back.
Is there any other federal funding available? Has Congress looked at this, replicating the model or providing, because there's clearly a benefit beyond the borders of the state of doing some of the more traditional salary supplement funding?
Not that I'm aware of.
Attorney Luger. Chief Deputy Kirkwood.
Chairman Latz, Chairman Dibble. I do want to address that. I have a unique position of being on, having been on both sides and seen it from both sides. And as Mr. Luger said, it's the amount of resources, time, money that the federal government puts in, for instance, Secret Service, postal inspectors, just on a day-to-day basis to the task force is really quite remarkable. It becomes their full-time mission working with the local law enforcement and doesn't doesn't ever, you know, obviously charge local law enforcement, but many of these agents work without any overtime, unlike my deputies who do get overtime. The agents aren't getting overtime at all. Just a good example, where my deputy is right now down in Atlanta with his postal inspector partner, we didn't have to pay for that, and the task force didn't have to pay for the travel and the hotel and everything else that's involved in per diem. The Postal Inspection Service, is my understanding, picked up that tab for my deputy to accompany him on that interview because he was so crucial to be with him on that interview. So there's a huge participation from the federal law enforcement aspect already in targeting a lot of these cases and crimes that are specific to the state of Minnesota, even though some do reach out into other jurisdictions. As we've seen, majority of these defendants were residing here in Minnesota.
I think it might be helpful to our evaluation if there was some way, even in a rough numbers, to quantify the amount of federal money and resources that are being dedicated to this as we contemplate at least trying to be somewhat proportional with state investment as well.
We have Senator Peterson, then Senator Carlson, then Senator Goodwin. Senator Peterson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to take this opportunity again. Thank you for the work you do, the men and women in uniform certainly that are here today, and then, of course, the offices that follow up on the work that you do in the field. Many Minnesotans are probably not as clear on the work that you do on a daily basis, and I found this very helpful. The question I really have for you, Mr. Chair, is it appears right now this funding request would likely come through transportation and public safety and judiciary. Is that correct?
Senator Peterson, that is correct. This account would be in the jurisdiction of the Finance Subdivision of Public Safety. I think judiciary would probably have some role to play, maybe shaping the policy. But certainly, at the end of the day, those sections of that finance bill get lumped into Senator Latz's finance bill that he will then take to conference committee, on which conference committee I will serve as well.
So if I heard you correctly, Mr. Chair, it's your intent to give the Transportation and Public Safety Committee a chance to vote on this increased funding?
Senator Peterson, yes.
Thank you. And question for Mr. Chair Latz as well. Is it your intention in judiciary to give your committee the chance to vote on this funding as well?
Well, certainly, Senator Peterson, if funding is proposed out of the Judiciary Division, then my committee will have the opportunity to vote on that, like on all budget items that come through the committee.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. And U.S. Attorney Lugar, thank you very much for bringing this to us. I have several questions that perhaps could be answered with a little more than one breath, but they relate to each other. I'm thinking also of just what the dimensions are of the challenges you have. For instance, the sizes of some of these threats in dollars. How do you prioritize them? By the number of people affected, by the dollar size, by the seriousness of the offenses? And then do you have impound authority? And do you focus anything on recovery? And what do you do if anything is recovered?
U.S. Attorney.
Chairman Dibble, Senator Carlson, each of these organizations that we end up investigating tend to victimize local businesses and individuals in the millions of dollars. There are many more cases that I did not highlight today that one could describe as smaller cases where individuals were engaging in ID theft, bank fraud, counterfeit check operations, and we've prosecuted them as well. So I've highlighted sort of the larger, more organizational cases in the Joku case. How to prioritize is one of the more daunting parts of my job because there is so much work to be done.
What we do is we tend to look at people who we believe are perpetrating the worst types of crimes on Minnesotans and Minnesota businesses. There are cases that we either cannot get to, or perhaps the volume of the fraud is smaller, and we are talking to our county attorney partners on a regular basis about taking some of those cases. One of the pleasures of this job is to be able to work with my county attorney partners on deciding who should do what case. We have a really robust dialogue, and we cooperate very well across the entire state, not only on financial crimes but on all types of crimes. The final question that you asked about, I think you used the term impound. There are federal forfeiture statutes that allow us, for example, with phones that we recover in a search, with the funds and the cars and the houses that are the profits of this fraud, that we're able to seize and return to victims. In this instance, we tend to do that upon conviction.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Senator Goodwin.
The funding is probably important for a number of reasons that were not even mentioned here. And part of that is that they need to also get the word out that the task force exists and get a number of smaller police departments, particularly who don't have a lot of resources and are not able to be really involved with this task force as much as they probably would like to and certainly need to. The use of like interactive TV for meetings would be a good thing. And I'm just really supportive of what they're doing. And I know that they should probably do this anyway, but as we know, that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen between our state agencies collaborating on issues. It doesn't happen between local, state, and federal governments normally to this point. And I think this is kind of a unique blend of the state, federal, and local governments being able to work together on some of our most expensive cases big victims, lots of big victims in these cases. So I just want to lend my support to the group and thank them for what they're doing.
Chief Deputy Kirkwood.
Chair Dibble, Senator Goodwin, thank you so much. And like I said, it's a pleasure having you on the board. And just to echo some of your comments, especially in regards to the branding and the advertising of the task force, even early when I was with the service, that was one of the frustrations, was that there was still a lot of departments in outstate, or I should say greater Minnesota, that maybe weren't aware of the things that the task force could do for them. And we struggled with this: how much should we advertise what we can do, how much can we bring to them? And one of the struggles was we didn't have enough resources to fulfill their needs, and we didn't want to overpromise and underdeliver. And again, it gets back to the amount of resources you have and limited resources you have and how much you can over advertise what you can do as a task force. And as you probably see from these cases, the majority, the handful of agents and deputies and officers, you can get them all right behind me in this one room, on the task force, are so committed right now and tied up with their investigations, these major investigations, there isn't a lot of time to do the other aspect of what they're required to do, and that's some of the training for state and local law enforcement throughout the state. We're hopeful with additional funding that we can, through technology, through travel expenses and other things, and additional members on the task force, we can get out to these other jurisdictions that don't have the experience in working in identity theft, an advanced fraud scheme, a HELOC fraud, or whatever it may be, and teach them how to do it. And that is part of the mission of the Financial Crimes Task Force. But again, it's a challenging mission because of the limited amount of money that we have to work with. But once again, Senator Goodman, thank you for your support and your kind comments.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Senator Dibble, Chair. My question is for U.S. Attorney Mr. Lugar. You stated a little about forfeited property, your ability to go in and seize that property, and I hear the committee, which I really understand, although those on the panel talking a lot about resources. So can you share with us what happens to forfeited property and any resources that's generated from that forfeited property? Is it shared amongst the other agencies or what?
Chairman
Lugar is a subject that U.S. Attorney Lugar has some familiarity with.
Absolutely.
And some sensitivity around around these parts on that subject. So, U.S. Attorney Lugar.
Chairman Dibble, Senator Champion. The way this works is that we're able to freeze assets, and upon conviction, we're able to then distribute either in forms of restitution or in sharing with local offices that participate. The problem with many of these crimes is by the time we have solved the crime and we're able to take down a large organization, there's not a lot left. But I will tell you that we are constantly looking at bank accounts of the criminals. We're looking at automobiles. Because of the transnational nature of some of these crimes, a fair amount of this money is going overseas. We're trying to get it before it does. But where we come across proceeds of the criminal activity upon conviction, there is a cost sharing. Some of this money does go back to local agencies. And where there are victims, there's restitution available. And we're very proud to be able to distribute money to victims.
Anything further, members? Senator Goodwin. Senator Goodwin, actually, could I persuade you maybe to take Senator Reinert's seat and speak into the microphone? I think he's gone because we're tape recording the proceedings. So you can come around and speak into the microphone. That would be better.
I know there's limited resources and limited cases that you can take, but I'm also interested in the task force being able to take looks at some financial crimes that are occurring maybe within the state and federally funded agencies or nonprofits or so forth, because we've recently had some big cases where there were millions of dollars that were misspent, and this kind of collaboration between the three agencies when, of course, federal, state, and local dollars are taxpayers' dollars are involved are very important. So I'm interested in maybe expanding some of the things that you do to be able to cover some of that as well.
Attorney Lugar.
Chairman Dibble, Senator Goodwin, typically government-related fraud allegations are investigated by our office with the FBI or other federal agencies, sort of separate from this task force. I can assure you that where there are serious allegations of wrongdoing, we're looking at it. This task force is focused primarily by necessity, I think, on the kind of counterfeit check, ID theft, bank fraud, and tax fraud work that we're seeing. So just as an organizational principle within my office and in how we work with our state and local and federal partners, we sort of divide up areas of responsibility, and the type of thing that you're talking about is typically investigated by the FBI and worked on by people in my office.
Thank you.
I did notice that the Board of Psychology or an employee at the Board of Psychology was involved in one of the cases. That was interesting. I think
Masquerade, yes. Yeah. It predated me, so that's right. Those cases matter, too.
I have Senator Carlson, then Senator Latz, and Senator Dietzick. Senator Carlson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess final comment about and looking forward here is are financial crimes getting easier or more difficult? Are they getting easier to follow up on? And also, you mentioned about the cell phones that are for sale in other parts of the world. Prior to making a common system, cell phones wouldn't work in another part of the world. Is there a technical solution to that that the U.S. phone companies or U.S.-based phone companies could invoke and then can cut out the market?
Attorney Lugar.
Chairman Dibble, Senator Carlson, first question, is it easier or is it more difficult to commit these kind of crimes and to investigate them? It's more complex. when I was a prosecutor, a line prosecutor in the 80s and 90s, everything was done in person and on paper. Telephone was really not a vehicle, other than certain types of scams, was really not a vehicle for committing crime, and there was no internet, and ID theft barely existed. So it is more complex. A lot of what we see now takes place on the internet. So somebody recently asked me if I was going to establish a cybercrime unit in my office because of the rise of cybercrime. The vast majority of crimes that we see now take place over the internet, so everything's a cybercrime, more or less. It is more time-consuming, more difficult to investigate because you have to go through layers of websites and emails to get there and subpoena email accounts, and it takes a long time. These are very labor-intensive investigations, and more sophisticated people are involved in them than in the old days. So that I think that answers your first question. What was I lost
phone, the second. Phones.
Oh. There are really smart people working on the answer to the question that you asked about cell phones and whether we can sort of shut them down. The short answer is right now, no. There are entities overseas who are seeking cell phones and are paying a lot of money for cell phones from crime rings in the United States, and Minnesota is one of the places that is supplying those phones, and they work when they get overseas no matter what happens here. Sorry.
Senator Latz.
Two things. One, on that point, I believe last year, if I remember right, we did pass some legislation relating to the cell phone companies themselves embedding software in their phones that can disable the operation of the phone if it's activated by the owner, appropriately done. So, but that was a tough conclusion to come to legislatively as well. I also just thought I'd throw out there some caution, and this has come up in Mr. Lugar's past appearance before the committee as well, but the use of the proceeds of forfeitures is a rather controversial issue, and I know the Judiciary Committee is going to be looking at legislation this year that will be considering how to handle that, what the link is between the use of the proceeds and the financial involvement or, and some would even say, to some degree, dependency of the agencies that are pursuing the forfeitures, and how to handle that and whether there's a conflict of interest and what would be the appropriate use of proceeds of forfeitures. So these are a lot of issues that are floating around this area, and we'll have more of an opportunity to look into those at a hearing before the Judiciary Committee.
I'll just say that Attorney Lugar's appearance on the subject was as a good actor on the subject.
Yes. Chairman.
U.S. Attorney Lugar.
Chairman Dibble, Chairman Latz, we take the issues that you're referring to very, very seriously. And I can at least at this point inform the committees that the vast majority of funds that are forfeited at the federal level by our office are used to pay money back to victims.
Restitution. Thank you. We have Senator Dietzick, and then Senator Senjum will have the final word because the hour has come. So, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson asked one of my questions, but I had a quick one, and I apologize if I missed this in the beginning. Thank you for all being here and everybody that's with you for working on this. Did you give us a cost? I know one of these cases there was $50 million in losses, but do you have an estimate of how much this is costing the state of Minnesota, how much these financial crimes are costing individuals and businesses across the state?
Chief Deputy.
Chairman Dibble, Senator Dietzick, I really don't know exactly what that number would be. I'm sure it's something we could work with DPS and BCA on, perhaps coming up with some figures. It's a difficult thing to capture also because so many of the losses are incurred by the financial institutions. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the financial institutions, the retailers get hit the hardest, and then oftentimes, unfortunately, those losses and costs are imposed upon consumers and victims through increased interest rates or fees or whatever else. So it's kind of a hard number to exactly capture, but I'm sure it's something we can look into and try to get some ideas on what those numbers would be.
And Senator Dietzick, sometimes those institutions suppress that information, and feel some sensitivity and exposure when those numbers get out. So yeah, it's hard to get a good read on that number, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. And I think it's also, I think it would be hard to quantify if you're the individual that was hit with that identity theft. It's a lot of time and money. How do you quantify, especially some of that time and just the angst of what they're, you know, who knows what else and what else you're going to find as they keep using your identity.
Thank you.
Chairman Dibble, if I could address it to Chairman Dibble and Senator Dietzick. You know, back from my fraud presentation days and identity theft presentation days with the Secret Service, we used to estimate about $1,100 per victim is tied up in legal fees, time wasted, the forms, everything else. It's probably a little easier these days because, quite frankly, the financial institutions are so good at helping victims when they are identity theft victims to the point they're actually notifying them for the first time because of unusual activity on their credit card or a charge in Bulgaria or someplace they don't assume they've ever been. But they're very good at working with their customers and getting this done. So I don't think the costs are quite as high, but the aggravation factor is still there and everything else that it causes, the inability to, in the midst of financing a house or getting a loan, you find out that you've been a victim of identity theft. Now you put that whole thing on hold, unable to get that loan or get your child's college education paid for because of somebody getting into your accounts. So there's always that impact. That's hard to put that number on.
We had a card in our family being used in Ecuador once, so shut that down pretty fast. Senator Sendrum, last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and particularly thanks to the group before us and all that support them in so many ways in this important area. And then I have just a question that initially I felt kind of silly even asking it, but the more I've listened and thought about this, it's sort of like one never knows. And it was just kind of a personal experience about a year ago or so. My credit card didn't work. I called the company, and they'd shut it down because somebody had ordered 3 magazines, which I, by the way, never got. And I believe it was $33. So, you know, ho-hum, life goes on, and you get a new credit card and so on. And I'm sitting here thinking, what if that happened to 10,000 other people in the same way? Then it is more serious. So my question is, and I certainly wouldn't bring this to the lofty Financial Crimes Task Force, but I suspect this has probably even happened to people around the table. Is that the kind of thing that we ought to be at least reporting to a local police agency? I didn't, frankly, at the time even think of it.
To our lofty witnesses.
Chairman Dibble.
Chief Deputy.
I'm sorry, Chairman Dibble. Senator, I'd like to address that. Absolutely. And the reason being is it's if they've gotten to that credit card, there's a chance that they've gotten to other credit cards or other accounts or other things within that you don't know about yet. You'll want to get a police report taken. Even if the police maybe cannot do anything, you'll use that as verification documentation to work with your financial institution or anybody else to prove that you've been a victim of identity theft if for some reason it spirals into other areas such as your credit or anything else. And with that, it's very important for everybody to take advantage of those free credit reports that you're able to get, the annual credit reports through the 3 credit reporting agencies. Get those done at least twice a year. And if you've been a victim of identity theft, maybe even more often, to make sure there's not any unusual charges on your accounts, suspicious charges or inquiries onto your accounts that you may not know about. So I wouldn't think it's anything too small. If you looked at some of the cases that we had, they started out as very small ATM transactions or counterfeit checks, and then they grew. They're like anthills. You step on them, and they're just huge. So my guess is whoever got your card and hit it for $33, you're right. I guarantee you they've hit it for thousands of other cards for $33. And an organization like the Financial Crimes Task Force, that's one of the things they can do, sure, is draw in those relevant contacts throughout the country and even throughout the world that are tied to that same scam.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's actually interesting information. I don't think this Ecuador situation has happened in our family a couple of times. Never occurred to us to call the cops. We'll have to talk about that a little more when we hear the subject in front of the Finance Committee. Anything further, members? Anything further? All right. Well, really appreciate your work. Let me echo the gratitude of members who've already expressed that. It's excellent work that you're doing without sufficient state support, so we look forward to having more conversation about how we can better support your your endeavors. With that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.